You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestall. Grand Tower, Illinois, is a place with a long history of strange events, odd lights in the sky, bloody massacres, and sightings of strange creatures. Joining me to delve into this area are filmmaker Joe Turi and Fortean investigator Michael Huntington, as we discuss their upcoming documentary, Grand Tower UFO and High Strangeness. We'll delve into some of the mysteries this area has to reveal. But before that, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. A big thank you to my latest patrons, Brenda, Sean, and Rebecca. Welcome to the team, and thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support me and Mysteries and Monsters. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media networks. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes. Our new merchandise site is available through TeePublic, so for all your show t-shirts, mugs, magnets, stickers, whatever you want, please visit TeePublic, and you can also click the link in the show notes to find the store there. Our intro and outro music is performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his wonderful artwork. The show is produced by Brendan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. To Illinois now, as we look to the strange history of the Mississippi River town of Grand Tower. In the early months of 1973, the Mississippi River town of Grand Tower, Illinois, saw a headline event that catapulted it even stranger than its history. What occurred that night seems to be nothing short of out of the ordinary for this particular area of high strangeness. Now in the subject of a new documentary, Grand Tower UFO, I'm delighted to welcome back filmmaker Joe Turi, along with a long overdue welcome to UFO fanatic Michael Huntington, to Mysteries and Monsters. Welcome, gentlemen.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Now, I've got a passing knowledge of the Grand Tower 1973 event, primarily because I think in the modern era, a lot of people have started to look at 1973 as a real big year for UFOs, especially across the States. I know a lot of people have focused on Pascagoula over the last 5 or 6 years, because obviously that's the towards the end of the year. But when you look at some of the events that occurred throughout that year, all over the States, from events in California and Missouri, even down, as we were saying, down to the lower states, there just seemed to be so much going on. And Grand Tower, I think, sometimes gets overlooked because it happened at the start of that year. And other events seem to be a bit more fantastical in regards to the UFO events that occurred in regards to those, but it's still a very important event, isn't it?
1973, it definitely within the UFO literature is considered a landmark year. It's the year of weirdness. It's called the year of the humanoids, the year of the creatures, the year of the monsters, because there was just so much high strangeness activity occurring across not just the United States, but in other countries throughout that time period. There was the encounters in Piedmont, where hundreds of people were seeing things. Pascagoula, as you said, had the encounter. There was the coin encounter.
Yes.
There were all sorts of creature sightings all across the country. Even within that region, you know, the Murfreesboro Mud Monster was going on. So there were sort of these little spots all over the United States that just made 1973 sort of a strange year. And definitely in southern Illinois and southeastern Missouri, it was no exception for strangeness for that year, definitely.
So what was it that sort of got your attention, Joe? Because I think when you've got the body of work that you've done some brilliant documentaries. And one of your specialities, I think, is that you focus on cases that perhaps have been overlooked or not realized into the potential that more people need to know about them. So was this a favorite case of yours, or was this one of those that you found something interesting about this and thought, yeah, this could be something worth delving into more?
Yeah, that's funny you say that. So I actually learned about Grand Tower when I was doing Creature from Big Muddy. That was my third documentary. And then a couple of the people in it, Kevin Lee Nelson, talked a little bit about Grand Tower and it being a possible window area. And then I'm pretty sure I asked Michael about it. And Michael's the one that told me about the UFO sighting in 1973. And I thought, well, heck, this might be a fun one to do. I like doing cases that are documented, not just, you know, word of mouth stories. You know, I like to have a little bit more substance. So when they're documented, it makes it a lot more interesting to me and helps me to dive into the case a little bit more, you know.
Was it a case that had always been on your radar, Michael? Is it one of those, as I said in the introduction, you're renowned in our circles for being a very diligent and boots on the ground investigator. You like to travel, and I wonder how many air miles you probably racked up in the search of strangeness across the United States continent.
It's a lot. I travel with my family, and you know, we go to places just like a normal family, you know, over the years, but with one difference in that I map anomalous locations. You know, that's my area of research. I GPS position anomalies with at least two sources, you know, haunted places, paranormal spots, cryptid encounter locations, UFO locations, places with, you know, strange electromagnetic phenomena, or, you know, places with a significant lore. Because within my area of research, I believe that if you're going to investigate these things, you're dealing with phenomena that are transient in nature. So the challenge to scientifically investigate these things is to minimize the transients. And the way to do that is to try to localize and see if, you know, there's some sort of geologic or geographic connection to where, you know, we can see it. If that's a causative source in some cases, and that's what I do. I try to find, you know, like hotspots, places where there's just a preponderance beyond statistical measurement of just probability, places where there's just a preponderance of a variety of phenomena. And is it sustained? Is it consistent? Is it found throughout history, throughout the folklore? And I go to these places and I document them. And I'm in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. And Grand Tower, Illinois is one of those places. And it's not too far from me. It's literally just a half an hour drive from where I'm at. But there's other locations like that that I visit nearby. But Grand Tower has it all. It goes back to the natives. Where they had, you know, their own specific lore as far as, you know, spirits and forbidden areas and all that. Everything is centered around this feature in the middle of the river called the Tower Rock, which is an anomaly within the Mississippi River that juts out like a tower. And it's been a feature back to the native times within their lore. And we know that it was part of, you know, that culture. You know, their mound culture civilizations throughout that area. And it goes back to the time of the Spanish. That was a Spanish-controlled area at one time. When the Spanish explorers went up the Mississippi, that rock was one of the reference points that they explored as, you know, like people looked for, you know, northern passages or, you know, lost fountains of youth, you know.
Yes.
And it's believed at one time that on the top of this rock was a big, like, Spanish cross. Uh-huh. That denoted, you know, the extension of Spanish territory. also that area around there in later times, you know, the Spanish drove the pirates from the rivers up to that area, and they congregated. So there were like river pirates and native massacres and, you know, several different massacres and floods and a lot of bad negative stuff has happened to Grand Tower over the centuries. And it's perpetuated throughout the years. You know, it is a small, impoverished river community that has gone through a lot of floods and stuff over the years. It was even named the unluckiest town in America by Time magazine at one time. So, you know, it's got all these things, and then it's got paranormal stuff. It's got ghosts, several different kinds of ghosts. It's got haunted houses, haunted cemeteries. It's got weird noises, electromagnetic phenomena. It's got cryptid sightings of different varieties, including the mud monster. And it's got UFOs and other sort of aerial light phenomena that has been experienced there over the decades and continues to this day. And it's one of those places. And that's what we're looking at. We're exploring this. We're getting people's ideas. We're sort of laying down, you know, some of the stories and some of the background for people to consider to explore this. And it's an interesting untold story. You know, it's like a Skinwalker type place, you know, or Marley Woods. It's a place where just there's just so much localized at one spot. And the UFO encounter plays a centerpiece in this because it's more contemporary. Some of the witnesses to it are still around that can connect us to all these varietal phenomena that are found in this really interesting spot.
I mean, the town's history is one of those places when I look into some locations that I'm interviewing people about their research or what they've been doing in certain locations. I've covered all kinds of places across the United States, and some of them have basically their local monster seems to have saved them. As I've spoken to Joe before, Van Meter is a prime example of that, because, you know, how would someone from the middle of England know anything about Van Meter in Iowa if it wasn't for a flying monster, Michael? And it's the same for a lot of places, and you only have to look at West Virginia. Point Pleasant is known around the world because of what happened. I would imagine before 1966, few people outside of that local area knew where Point Pleasant was. And so it's remarkable when you have places like this and populations, because you look at the history of Grand Tower and what's gone on. And as you refer to that Time article that said it was the unluckiest town in America, it just seems to be one of those places where you think, why does anybody live here? Because it keeps flooding. And they've ended up in a situation where the government and the local authorities have fallen out. So nobody's got flood insurance anymore. The Mississippi keeps bursting its banks. Nobody wants to pay for all the houses redoing, and everybody's just leaving. And you just think, well, if there was going to be an area that strange things would be occurring, I would not be surprised, because even the normal people can't seem to cope with what the environment throws at them.
Yeah, it's just one of those communities that, you know, your typical river community that at one time had a purpose and was bustling, and now it's not like a bad place or anything like that, but it's definitely not thriving. You know, the power plant that once, you know, employed many people is now going under. It's no longer an operational power plant, you know. So, I mean, people live where they want to live. It's in a beautiful area. So, you know, some people like that small town community. It's not really that far from other places off the beaten path, you know, like 30 minutes from Cape Girardeau, for example. And you can go another 30 minutes, well, less than, to like Murfreesboro and East St. Louis and things like that. It's just one of those side places along the river that people have almost forgotten about, you know?
Yeah, it reminds me of some of those communities that are on Route 66 that the road just passes them by, and if you blink, you'll miss them.
Yeah, I think the only reason folks would go to visit Grand Tower would be because it has a fantastic access bank there to the Mississippi. And if you want to fish or if you want to camp, they do have a great park there along the riverbanks, and they have fairs and festivals and stuff. Yeah, it's not the third world or anything. It's a small town. There's like 600 people. A lot of them are just a few families, right? And they've lived there because they've lived there. That's their home. And they ran around there when they were kids. And and they grew up with all these stories. And they're not really exploiting it. And we're trying not to either. We want to tell the story, because it's an interesting spot. And if people want to go there and explore that place and look around and spend a few bucks in the gas station, because that's really the only place you're going to. That's it. They got a gas station. they're nobody's trying to rake anything in or whatever. But there's a lot of these small towns, and there's a lot of people, as I've said before, there's a group of us researchers that like visiting these small towns and researching the lore, not just for the history of it, not just for the subject, not just the document, but to also benefit these towns. And it is of benefit. And I think they should, these small towns should celebrate their own folklore and their own urban legends, These people aren't making this stuff up, A lot of the people with Mothman stories and all this stuff, they're going away, They're not around anymore. A lot of these older witnesses and stuff. So I think these small towns like, Kelly near Hopkinsville and, I went to the Buck Nelson Festival recently. I went to the Piedmont UFO Festival recently. And these small towns are doing this because, maybe they want to add a new addition to their library or get some additional. I know in Kelly, that's why they had their festivals. It was for fire equipment. Hey, let people come, let people celebrate. There's nothing wrong with that cultural aspect to it. And I hope that we can help, the people in Grand Tower be proud of their history, not believe everything. You don't have to believe anything. It's just a story. And these are ultimately just different views and interpretations and ideas of what's going on. But there's always got to be this lore attached to this location.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah. Well, I think, like you say there, Michael, I think it's vitally important that towns like this do celebrate their folklore and their history and their legends, because they're things worth celebrating for, and it allows the people to be proud. Like we've been saying about some of the articles about this place have been very disparaging. It's kind of like it seems to be sort of promoted by the media as that kind of place that people can't wait to get out of. And I think that's one of those things that, coming from where I come up in the north of England, there's places like that as I grew up that people were always, couldn't get out of it fast enough if we were to believe everything we're told. But we quite like living where we live. The weather's not brilliant, but it's all right. And so when you've got places like this, I think especially in this day and age, where you've got a bigger reach, where you can achieve a level of infamy or notoriety, not necessarily because of what you're saying, but because of some of the stories that people would not have been aware of. And I think with the Grand Tower thing, it's the UFO that brings people in, as you guys say. But there's so much more going on. Like you say, you've got a whole range of history. You've got these wonderfully weird stories attached to both, is it the Devil's Backbone and the Devil's Mound? Which is one of those things that makes you scratch your head straight away. Devil's Bacon. And you think, well, hang on a minute. Why are these things called after the devil? Because there's so many places like that around the US as well, which make you scratch your head and think. And a lot of those have strange occurrences that have happened over the years. And it makes you think, well, if you've got a couple of places like this, there's got to be more to this. So the UFO is really just scratching the surface, because it just seems to be a magnet for weirdness.
What's interesting with Grand Tower, and I got a kick out of this, is, yeah, there is a, there's like a rocky ridge, where the pirates had their caves and encampments and all that, called, the Devil's Backbone. And that's the name of the park right there. And there's this little section, this hill, where there used to be a kind of like a castle-like house, you know, and it's haunted by the ghost of a girl named Esmeralda. You know, classic riverboat, rich, you know, daughter, you know, forbidden love, throw yourself off a cliff type story that you hear.
Yes.
But that's right there at the Devil's Bake Oven. And what's interesting, they're tearing it down now, but what's interesting is right out of the Devil's Bake Oven is a natural gas pipeline that goes across the river, which I just think is hilarious irony that you literally have a place that's been called the Devil's Bake Oven for the longest time, and then you actually have natural gas coming out of it. And you would hear that hiss of the, you know, like at night there in Grand Tower, you would like hear the, like the hiss of the gas pipe unexpectedly, you know, and it would just scare the crap out of you. Fun place, interesting place. And it's those little details that make it interesting.
Yeah.
You know, it's little stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think as well, it's one of those places that I think people don't realize what it's next to, because obviously you've next to Grand Tower, not too far away, you've obviously got the beautiful Shawnee National Forest, which is it's one of those places that when I saw it for the first time, my jaw dropped, because it's just full of such incredible sites and locations in there. And once again, it's a location well known for cryptids. It's probably one of those places that most people don't know what it is, but they probably know the statue that they've seen on pictures, because they've got that wonderful Sasquatch there called Sassy there, I think, that's on the road that thousands of people stop every year to have their picture taken with it. And I think it's one of those Bigfoot statues that's really famous without people knowing where it's actually happening.
Yeah, that's at a Garden of the Gods, which is in a different section of the Shawnee. The Shawnee's like 300,000 acres spread out across southern Illinois. But yeah, you know, you mentioned Big Muddy Monster, which people in Grand Tower also said they saw. Enfield Horror. We have our own Enfield Horror in Illinois.
Yes, you do. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's always the stories of, we have a lot of stories of Sasquatch and other creatures in southern Illinois. You know, when you have a vast wilderness like that, it's sparsely populated compared to the rest of the state. So,
I was just going to say, you have to mention that, you know, southern Illinois, this area that we're talking about, is, you know, where Loren Coleman got his start.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. You know, probably the most famous cryptozoologist on the planet right now, very respected person who investigated all these cases originally, you know, the Enfield Horror and the Mud Monster and all these southern Illinois cryptids and Bigfoot type characters. And I interact with him every once in a while. You know, I try not to bother him because he's a very busy guy. But, you know, when I show him a picture of a spot, you know, and I'm trying to make sure I have the exact location, I did that with Enfield. You know, I took pictures and then sent them to like Loren Coleman to get his, you know, impression. And I think that's a great way to do it. I've done that with several different cases. Talk to the original, you know, researchers. Make sure you have the right spot when you're documenting. It's a good way to go. And I think a lot of researchers need to do that more. Interact with each other more. You know, get the information, share it with each other. There's a business aspect to it, and there's certainly a culture, you know, a competitive culture. But there's also a lot of people that are more interested in documenting this stuff accurately and getting the information so that it can be used and other researchers can share and benefit from the research.
Yeah.
Stepping back a little bit, you were talking about like Point Pleasant and just other places that kind of capitalize a little bit on their monster history. I think one of the unusual aspects of Grand Tower is there's not many people there that actually know about the UFO, and they don't try to capitalize on it at all, probably because of lack of knowledge about it. Just recently, we had the total eclipse, and Grand Tower was the first
Yes.
First place in the in Illinois that was under, you know, total darkness. And I think they had a little festival there, and there was a vendor there selling T-shirts with the UFO on it. And I asked them about it, and I think they kind of are trying to capitalize on some of, you know, on the fact that they know we're making a documentary on it. So it's like, it's not one of those towns that are trying to, you know, use this event to help bring in tourists or anything like that. Like most of them don't even know about it, which is kind of interesting to us.
Yeah. I suppose as well, this is as we were saying about the town's history, this is one of the issues that I think is can be overlooked. And so I think it's vitally important when you're doing a documentary like this that you get in now, because as you say, I mean, it's 51 years since these events. People pass on. We've seen that over events. And while for some of us, you know, we sometimes suffer from that memory thing where we think 20 years ago, oh, it's 1984. Maybe right. I'm speaking yeah. for myself yeah. there. No. I'm hitting that age where a lot of my favorite albums start turning 40 this year, and that's right. when I'm getting concerned. So I'm in denial, I think. So yep. essentially, when you've got something like this, not only is it important to deal with the case and document it and think this area is really interesting, you've obviously got a finite amount of time to speak to people who could actually either remember it or saw it. And I think this is one of the key aspects of this is getting it done whilst we still can, because there are so many cases where we look back that happened in the 1920s, the 1930s, the 1940s, even in normal history, that any sort of insight to those events has been completely lost to us because nobody at that particular period of time thought it relevant enough to record it. And therefore, even if we are talking about the strange and the unusual and folklore, these are important things. And I think that, for me, I would imagine for you guys, was probably the biggest challenge in this, was trying to track people down who either remembered it or saw something.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things that attracted myself to Michael, because Michael goes around and documents these things for a good reason, right? And so we were fortunate enough that a couple of the family members that were the main witnesses are still around today and getting up there in age, but they still remembered everything pretty clearly, you know, fortunately. And so again, I agree with you 100%. It's important to grab onto these things when we can and try to document it as accurately as possible.
You could always tell the story. I mean, you know, there's plenty of historical documentaries where none of the people are around anymore, and you can extrapolate, you can talk to experts, and you can do all that. But hats off to Joe for going that extra mile and, you know, making an effort to get these people on record, historically on record. Not that it's anything, you know, it's not like Watergate. It's nothing big. It's not going to change the universe. It's not going to change science. It's small town folklore. And it's also an extraordinary claim, a fascinating extraordinary claim that, if true, has interesting implications that are of interest to a lot of people, especially now, you know, as a lot of people are engaged in discussion of, you know, what UFOs are, what anomalous phenomena are, what the paranormal is, what cryptids are. Are they all from some single source? Are there such places like a Grand Tower that has like a portal to where, you know, the veil between reality or perception or whatever, you know, maybe at times it sort of gets mixed up there. It's a fact, though, that there are a lot of claims. You can't take that away. It's a fact that that place in the river has electromagnetic anomalies that are unexplainable. Riverboat people will tell you. We'll talk to some of those. What were the UFOs that people saw? You know, these are professional people that were connected to a power plant. That's serious business, you know, and when it's the place where it's the only source of income, really, you know, people aren't going to mess around with that. They're not going to play games. Something was seen, whether it was had some sort of natural connotation or something else. You know, we can't ignore the fact that there was a bunch of other stuff seen nearby. And we can't ignore the fact that there were multiple claims of jets flying in the air you know, doing what, 8 suites, 4 jets? We're only touching the surface of this mystery. You know, hopefully more researchers can look into this further, you know, maybe find out what the jets, where they were located, or if there's more witnesses, or if there's paperwork. Like anything, there's more to explore with these stories.
I think it's one of those cases as well, because it's kind of got a double whammy for anybody who loves a strange case, that you've got, once again, that seems to have occurred quite a lot at that period at the end of the 60s, early 70s. You've got strange lights being seen over power plants, nuclear silos, places of heavy industry, energy. There seems to have been a real connection for that period for whatever reason. Or maybe it's just that people noticed it more, because a lot of these buildings were local landmarks. But also you've got the fact that one of the main witnesses, I think Oscar Wills, was a complete skeptic. He thought all UFOs were all nonsense, and it was all just people making things up and having tall tales and pulling each other's legs. And he went from being a complete skeptic to a believer because of what he saw. And that was down to, was it people were ringing up and saying, we think there's something wrong above the station?
So the story in a nutshell is another gentleman, Willis Hughes, who also worked at the power plant. He wasn't working at the time. He was living in, or he was at his home, which is like a mile and a half, 2 miles away from the power plant. One of his family members, which she gives her testimony in the documentary, actually was noticing this dancing light in the sky. She said she was watching it for about 40 minutes or so, and then told her dad about it. Her dad, Willis, was checking it out, and then he noticed that it went over to the power plant. And just from the vicinity, you know, he couldn't see the power plant from his window, but he knew from driving there every day where it was. So he called the power plant, got a hold of Oscar Wills. Oscar Wills came out and pretty much confirmed, yeah, there's something above the power plant right now. You know, Oscar actually ended up calling the headquarters of the power plant company, CIPS, I believe, in Springfield, which is right outside where I live right now. So, I mean, it not only was rumors, or, you know, it's not just stories by the town. They contacted their employer, their major, you know, major employer about the event. Oscar was interviewed in Fate magazine by Jerome Clark about the event. And actually, Dr. Hynek actually got involved with the research as well. So yeah, I'm pretty sure Oscar was a believer after he witnessed it for multiple minutes over the power plant.
And there were actually multiple encounters. So it wasn't just, you know, one encounter. I think it was a return the March 22nd, and then it returned in April. So yeah, and then 60 miles away in Piedmont, you got hundreds of people. And Hynek was over there, you know, so Hynek was in the neighborhood. I'm sure he was getting all these, I think like CBS News and a bunch of other people were down in Missouri covering all that stuff, you know, just on the other side. 60 miles is nothing with I guess, if you're a flying saucer, right? It's all, even if you're a jet, you know, so it's actually, you know, I think it's part of that larger regional activity. You know, I think that's the extension of that UFO activity to the east. But of course, you know, then you have all the cryptid stuff going on all around the same time, just to the east of that. It was crazy, you know, crazy times, a lot of stuff going on in this area. It would have been interesting to be there to see what's going on. You know, somebody saw something.
Well, I once heard a theory which was based at some of the UFO sightings around the Joshua Tree military base down that end. And somebody, I was reading something, and somebody said, well, actually, I don't think the UFOs are coming for the military. They're coming for all the Bigfoot sightings in the local area. And so they were kind of postulating that we're all getting this wrong. They're not interested in the military bases. It's because there's so many Bigfoot seen around them that they're actually coming to spot them. And whilst they might have been a very tongue-in-cheek quip that somebody had made, We've no idea, because once again, this is an area of high strangeness. And just because these lights were seen above the power plant doesn't mean it was interested in the power plant. It might have been everything else that's going on here that they just thought, well, as you, Michael, it may be extraterrestrials have a very similar list to yourself and your family, that they go, right, well, we've heard this area is really weird. It's on our Earth weird spot location list. Let's go there.
Yeah, I mean, we can speculate. You know, we can do all the... It's ironic because I was watching a $6 million man episode, the one with the Bigfoot and aliens, right before this interview, just coincidentally. But that's what the times were back then. You know, back in the 70s, you had, you know, the ancient astronaut stuff and the Bigfoot stuff and all this craziness on TV, UFOs and everything sort of inundating the culture. And the rural culture was influenced by tabloid journalism, tabloid media, sensational TV and science fiction, just like everybody else. So not to discount anything, but Bigfoot and UFOs were very familiar during that time period. Is there a connection between the two? Yeah, there's a lot of story. There are a lot of stories of like UFO, Bigfoot, like where the Bigfoot is involved, like either coming out of the UFO or going into a UFO. There's a few Missouri cases like that. But who knows? Maybe you're right. Maybe it's they're coming to look at the Bigfoot, or maybe there's just some sort of weird veil is lifted, you know, between realities, and it sort of gets blurry at times. Who knows?
That's funny. Like before I started filming this, like I'm not really into high strangeness. You know, I'm not a UFO guy so much. I'm more of a Bigfoot guy. So I never really believed in that connection. But I mean, that's not to say I know the answers. I obviously don't know the answers. But yeah, I mean, now I find high strangeness interesting because it makes you wonder, is it all connected? I mean, and this stuff didn't stop in 1973. I'm getting witnesses that are telling me stories today, you know, that they're still seeing all these strange anomalies. I believe just a few years ago, we had our own Mothman in the area, right, Michael? Wasn't that like about 4 or 5 years ago?
Yeah, well, we had two Mothman sightings in Cape Girardeau. So, and that's where I'm at. I'm about a half an hour away from Grand Tower. Yeah, I hope it's not a portent of bad luck. We have a really nice bridge here that I think is constructed well. But, you know, fingers crossed. I don't know the creatures that were alleged to have been seen here. We can theorize. I think one was probably some sort of flock of birds, you know, maybe just misidentified the wrong way. I don't know what the other one could be, but yeah, it's weird having a Mothman encounters in your own town just pop up randomly.
I suppose that, well, that's the danger of having an area of high strangeness. Nothing's off the table, really. And it's one of those things like Joe refers to there. I was never really into window areas before I started doing this show 5 years ago, Michael. The more people I've spoken to, and I've even visited a couple here in the UK now, they're just really strange, baffling places because all kinds of things get reported. And I think one of the frustrations I have now looking back to certain periods of time is it all depended on what certain researchers were into, because not everybody's got a broad church of interests when it comes to the weird. And I think as we've developed over the last sort of 20 years, more people have gone back to that kind of Keelian idea, Michael, of looking at everything and wanting to know not just about UFO sightings. Perhaps people have a ghost story. Perhaps somebody's seen a strange creature either in the sky or in the woods. Perhaps they walk somewhere and their watch stops and it doesn't make any sense, or their car battery dies. And I think a lot of people, if you've got a certain UFO investigator, for example, he went to, people may have told him certain stories, but because they weren't about UFOs, he wasn't interested. And so now I think high strangeness seems to be coming back into into the radar of Fortean research, because people are now able to say, well, yes, I am interested in UFOs and strange lights in the sky, but I'm also interested in time anomalies or strange creature sightings or ghost stories. There's not this disconnection that there used to be 20, 30 years ago, I think.
Yeah, and I'm not suggesting that there's a single source. In fact, you know, it sort of frustrates me when people say, you know, the phenomenon, like it's like one causative, you know, like it's a deity or something.
Yes.
And it's, you know, the cause of everything. We know that, you know, for instance, like in UFOs, most UFOs, like 95% are misidentifications. So the notion that everything can be explained by one causal thing, you know, that's right out the window. You know, and then we have the smaller percentage of true anomalies. And, you know, there are hoaxes there. There are misidentifications. There's probably secret programs, maybe some unknown natural phenomena. You know, and as we whittle away, the truly high strangeness stuff, you know, where you have creatures and aliens and sort of the really bizarre stuff, that's a really small, rare thing. And if we're looking to study these, as I've said, you know, for me, trying to minimize the transient nature of these very rare, disparate phenomena that have likely a variety of causes, all of benefit to science, I think, because anything that's anomalous and us trying to figure it out is of benefit. Whatever the answer is, you know, the goal is not to prove aliens or anything. The goal is to find out what the answer is. You know, it's not to prove a Bigfoot. It's the that's why I look at things on a case by case basis, claim by claim, person by person, evidence by evidence, and not everything's equal. Not every case is more not every case is valid. There's a variety of what's valid, and there's a variety of a very small, you know, margin of what's really credible and really interesting. As somebody who's been a researcher for 47 years, we have to do that. We have to sort of cut through a lot of the wheat and the chaff. We don't discard it because all of the whole story is part of the whole story. We take everything and we maintain that evidence. We maintain those facts. And we put everything in an accurate historical context, and we measure likelihoods in things. You know, what is the likelihood of, you know, this being a natural thing or not? And finding these places, not that there's, again, a single thing. I don't necessarily believe in, like, window areas. But I am interested in why some places are geographically more significant than others statistically, just by having a larger preponderance of varietal anomalies. I want to look through those, and I want to find out and see if there is some sort of causal thing. Maybe it's geological. At Grand Tower, if they're having electromagnetic anomalies there, then that suggests that there's some sort of geologic something going on. And a lot of these hotspots, these anomalous places, do have interesting geology going on, you know, interesting formations with running water, and that might create electromagnetic effects that maybe alter perception. Maybe it does break down veils. Maybe it does cause us to hallucinate or have hypnagogic things go on. Or maybe it opens up dimensional portals. I mean, you know, we can speculate, but the key is to find these places, not with the intent of proving one single source, but finding the places that, you know, you have projects like Galileo starting up, you know, where they're wanting to put scientific arrays at these anomalous places, but they're not putting them at places like this. You know, they're putting them, you know, where a TV crew can film. You know what I'm saying? It's not really scientific. I would think that someplace like Grand Tower or Marley Woods or some, you know, one of these places that has, you know, sustained anomalies is your best way to minimize transients and to be able to, engage in long-term scientific study. Hopefully they'll get the message eventually. Hopefully we can get some cameras at places like this, and we can open it up and, you know, have competitive projects looking at these spots.
Yeah. But I think this is often the danger, because even when we think about the scientific disciplines, most of them have only been around for 200-300 years as a serious case of study. And so I often get frustrated. My stepfather was a doctor of chemistry. So I often get frustrated where people seem to think, well, we know everything now. We've explained everything. And I think, well, we know a lot more than we used to do, but we're still learning. And I think there is this strange perception that everything in chemistry and physics has been explained and calculated and documented, and we know why things happen. And yet we still see changes in the way the world around us is viewed. We discover strange phenomena in the skies above us, in the ground beneath us, all the time. And yet I think in general the perception is science is the answers for everything, but it keeps changing. I mean, one of the probably the best examples in the modern age, rogue waves, which were completely dismissed for centuries. You know, tall tales, sailors, you can't trust them, they're all drunk on rum, that kind of stuff. But essentially, until one went smashing into an oil rig in the North Sea, nobody believed it. And then all of a sudden, all these stories that people say, yeah, we were on this boat and this wave came out of nowhere and swamped us, smashed it to bits. And it made me wonder. I remember watching a documentary about this, and they were showing a ship off the coast of South Africa, and it had a hole punched through. It was an oil tanker, and it had been punched through like somebody had just taken a great big cannon and rammed it straight through it. And I thought, how on earth can you explain that away by anything other than a rogue wave? And they were like, oh, well, he probably hit a rock. What, in the middle of the sea? What do you mean? And if he had hit a rock, I don't think he'd have driven off from it, really. You know, these are not the kind of incidents you sail away from. And now we suddenly discover that, oh, yeah, well, actually, we used to say they were quite rare. And now they're saying that they're far more common than people ever realized.
Your turn, Joe.
Yeah, but then you have the other side where this is what kind of drives me crazy, is when researchers, and I hate to say not legitimate, but more like weekend warrior researchers, come up with their own theories, and that's a fact. Example.
Yeah.
I hear a knock in the woods. Bigfoot hits trees and makes wood knocks. Does he? Does it? Does it? Just because everybody says that's what it is? Or I have my EMF reader, you know, so this phenomenon is made up of electricity, therefore I can read it with this meter. Can you? I'm not saying that's not true.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying they're incorrect, but I hate it when those things become fact amongst people that research phenomenon. It's like, yeah. I don't like speaking in absolutes like that. You do not know. No one knows. Please do not say it as a fact, right?
Yeah, so. And you have a good point in that, you know, there are a lot of amateurs within all of the paranormal, cryptid, UFO fields that are engaging in pseudoscience, and even in some instances, ritual. Mm. You know, you know, we can have a separate argument as to, you know, whether science is its own ritual, but certainly, like CE5 is a meditative ritual. You know, it's not necessarily a scientific technique. No. Science is determined, and this is my background. I studied philosophy of science at Southeast Missouri State. I specialized in pseudoscience demarcation, which is, there's a whole branch of the philosophy of science which denotes what constitutes pseudoscience and what constitutes science. Now, a lot of people within these fields, as amateur scientists, and there's nothing wrong with that, you know, I'm not a scientist. I don't claim to be. You know, I'm just a regular person, and a lot of people within these fields are, knowing the techniques, knowing what denotes a proper method, knowing what is sufficient evidence, knowing how to fulfill claims, you know, what justifies a claim, what is actually evident of something, you know, what is a proof, what is a proper technique. All of these things, I think, within all of these research realms, need to be considered more, because everybody talks about, you know, like a paradigm shift, you know, scientific revolutions, you know, within these realms. But a lot of folks don't know what that means. And what that means is, in order to change the existing paradigm, you have to change the consensus, the establishment consensus. And the way you do that is through, you know, like peer review and science, you know, scientific programs and publishing and doing all that stuff within the scientific realm. We sort of have like a cultural movement within the paranormal and you know, UFOs and cryptids, and in that the goal is sort of, you know, trying to persuade the public. But that's not necessarily how science works. You know, everybody can be convinced that Bigfoot exists, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it exists scientifically and evidentiary wise. There might be some evidence out there, but nothing is conclusive, right? It's always sort of subjective. And these techniques that are used, you know, the ghost hunting techniques and a lot of the cryptid techniques are traditional techniques passed on within the subcultures. They're not anything. Wood knocking, as Joe said, it's not a scientific thing. We have no behavioral studies showing that Bigfoot does that. Some old Bigfooters, you know, wear camo, think that it does, so everybody does that. I think a lot of the wood knocks are one Bigfooter on one side of the forest, not knowing that there's another Bigfooter on the other side, you know, and they're talking to each other.
Yeah.
You know, which is what happens. You know, yeah. You get these reaffirming, self-reaffirming things within these pseudoscience practices. You know, you get people hearing what they want to hear on spirit boxes.
Yeah.
But I can tell you this also, when you put yourself in these anomalous places, weird things do happen. You get weird synchronicities, and you do get, you know, things on spirit boxes that have like a significance beyond just coincidence. Huh. You know, you do go into places where people have seen creatures, and you hear things, and there's things that you can't explain, you know. So there's the mystery there, and the subculture and all the rituals and all that goes with that. And a lot of it's influenced by media and television. Hmm. You know, everybody shooting themselves in green, you know, and meanwhile the creature, the ghost is over there, and oops, we missed it. It's frustrating. The pseudoscience is frustrating. It's entertaining. It's formulaic. It's reality TV. A lot of this stuff, even the techniques that are taught, you know, they're extended from the TV stuff. But if the goal is to do some science, is, you know, we need some Bigfoot poop. We need some Bigfoot hair. We need a Bigfoot corpse. I need a ghost in a bottle. Yes. I'm open to ghosts. I've seen them. I've photographed them. I want to know how it works. Oh. You know, how does the metaphysical interact with the physical?
Yeah.
What is, how is a consciousness able to move, and how is it able to see? Yeah. You know, how is it? There's all these things that we need to go to the next level with, beyond just, oh yeah, I took a picture of an orb. And you can take 1,000 pictures of an orb, and what are you going to have? You're going to have 1,000 pictures of an orb. You're not, turn on the lights in your haunted place, put up cameras for years. You know, a lot of people aren't doing that sustained stuff because a lot of, nothing intended against you, Joe, but a lot of people are media oriented. Nobody wants to do the long-term sustained stuff. So, so we have to create things like this to get interest, I think, to get people interested in these unusual places. So maybe down the road we can have some science getting done.
Well, I think that's if you look at, as you mentioned there, Michael, it's a prime example. If you look at ghost hunting against actual parapsychology, they're essentially completely different things. They're not the same exactly. thing at all. And you would, as someone that loves the supernatural, I am heavily leaning into the parapsychologist way of investigating, because I've seen enough and I know enough that most of these gimmicks and gadgets and all sorts are just nonsensical. They're self-affirming toys, essentially.
Right.
They tell you what you want to see, hear. I've seen people misidentify the data, as you were saying about EMF meters earlier, Joe. Do they actually know how they work? Because this is the other thing, like you touched on as well, Michael, about going out looking for Bigfoot. How many people who go into the woods know anything about the woods other than the fact that Bigfoot might live in there? They don't know anything about the fauna, the flora. They don't know what animals are there. They don't know what noises the animals make. And for me, I find that a little bit baffling, because we've had it here where I've heard people claim that they've recorded, obviously, the infamous British Bigfoot. And it's a fox. You can tell it's a fox if you know what a fox sounds like. If you don't know what a fox sounds, which is remarkable, really, living in the UK. If you don't know what a fox sounds like, it's bloody terrifying at 2 a.m. But it's not a Bigfoot. It's a fox. And that even in the States, obviously, I think you have this misconception that people are always wandering around the woods hiking all the time, and they're not. A lot of places are quite clear, apart from on a weekend, like you say, and you get a lot of weekend warriors turning up with a camping, and they go out, like you say, they're banging pans and banging sticks on trees and hoping that, and they're whooping at each other 3 miles apart, but they don't know what else is going on there. And I find that there are some Bigfooters out there who are coming at it far more scientifically now, and you've got people like Cheyenne Covington. You know, people who are doing tracking courses and learning about the woods and the forests, so they know what it isn't, rather than just, as you see so many people and they're filming themselves, any strange noise in the woods at night, it's got to be Bigfoot. Well, why?
Right, right. And so I think our goal in this film is not to convince the audience that something happened or something is still happening or whatever, like... We try to present it in a way of here's what people are saying they've seen. This is what they've experienced. You can be the judge, right? And we kind of have it a mixed bag of our experts. So we also have people that are a lot more experienced in the subject than I am, definitely, like Steve Ward and Zelia Edgar, who are our high strangeness experts. We have Kevin Lee Nelson, who is more of an area researcher like Michael. And then Ken Gerhard, who is more into cryptozoology, right? So you have those people that give their opinions on the subject matter, like an overview. And then we have our locals who tell what they saw. But again, not trying to convince anybody if it's real or not real, or, you know, hopefully people will see this and make up their own minds. Now, yes, I am in the media, as Michael likes to put it. And I do like to make my documentaries a little bit entertaining as well. That doesn't mean I'm doing jump scares or anything like that, but you do have to hold the audience's attention, you know, but just trying to make a true film that doesn't try to exploit the situation. Hopefully that comes across.
Yeah. And obviously with Michael appearing on here tonight, that means I've got all your experts have appeared on this show, Joe.
Oh, yeah. Well, has Zelia been on your show?
Of course.
Oh, awesome, awesome. I love her. I think she's Steve Ward refers to her as like the next John Keel. Yes. I kind of believe that.
No, but all those researchers, I'll say this, those are top-notch researchers. Steve, you know, is out there at the Mothman Museum. Zelia is the tinfoil hat. She has her channel on YouTube. Just giving away great history for free.
Yeah.
It's all about sharing the lore. And, you know, that's how we learn the lore. You know, we learned it by researching it and by sharing it in a way that's truthful. Yeah, you don't need to be overly sensational, and you certainly don't need to exaggerate or change the facts of things. That's what you have a lot within, like, you know, UFOtainment and all that. Everybody's going for the sensation. Everybody's going for the, you know, the extreme version of high strangeness, interpreted in a, you know, a reality TV show sort of way. And I've always said that you don't need to do that. You know, if you tell the real stories for UFOs and cryptids, ghosts, whatever, if you tell it in the most realistic way, you know, which is why I say always, you know, go to the location and work with real people that were there. The real stories are just so much more interesting, you know. Hollywood never gets it right. And I think the people that are doing it right within the documentary realm, there's a lot of stuff that's just put out now. You can go to different streaming channels and you can see that, you know, it's all just computer graphics and it's thrown together. You're going to get more of that. You're going to get more AI created. There's going to be we're going to be inundated with this stuff over the next few years. And Hollywood has its own formulas, you know, but it's people like Joe that are getting into these small towns and telling the stories accurately. And that's what makes it compelling. They're going to the places and telling things honestly and considering things honestly, you know, not interpreting it through just one lens. They're treating the audience like adults. And too often television treats its audience like what, 13-year-olds, I think is what the reality TV show goal is. And, you know, we don't need that. We're adults. We can take the facts. We can take the details. We can take the different arguments. We can take the stories told well, and it can be entertaining, and it doesn't have to be, you know, overly done up and to where you're trying to pull the wool over on somebody's eyes. You know, there's too much of that, I think.
I think as well, one of the key aspects that often gets overlooked in situations like this is respecting the witnesses as well, because once you start to take their story and their narrative and adding bits to it and spicing it up and whatever, then you've taken that story away from it. It's not their story anymore. And often you will either see examples of that or examples of somebody coming to you and saying, this happened to me. And then somebody says, well, actually, what happened to you is this. But you're not listening to them. You're then, once again, you're telling them what you think their experience fits into your narrative, not theirs. And I suppose when you're doing something like this, gents, was that a difficulty for people to be honest and come forward about their experiences, or were they quite open and happy to share what had happened to them because they were able to feel comfortable enough to know that what they told you was what we see?
Yeah, that's always a touchy subject, because you want to tell the story. You want it to be entertaining in a sense. You want to tell the truth, but you don't want to exploit it either. You know, a lot of like ghost shows or, you know, documentaries, they say ghosts occur because of traumatic experiences, for example. So in a sense, you're kind of exploiting those people that suffered those traumatic experiences, right? And so it's always a touchy subject to, like, I don't want to exploit Grand Tower. I don't want people there feeling, oh my God, this documentary came out, everybody thinks we're weirdos, everybody thinks we live in a terrible place, everybody, you know, blah, 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 you know, we're seeing lights and cryptids and UFOs night and day. You know, I don't want it to come across like that. You know, these are good people that live there, you know, and you want to be respectful of that. You know, some of the witnesses are all for it. I think the people I have that are more into the cryptid side of things, they love sharing their stories. I think for whatever reason, the cryptid things seem to be more mainstream, at least around here. You know, the UFO witnesses, well, the older ones we talked to could care less. They you know, they're like, this is what happened. I don't really give a bleep what people think about it. I really, you know, and then I had another one of the family members I talked to. She didn't want to appear on camera because she, you know, she's got a professional background. She was very reluctant. But then her brother talked about it. So she's like, well, cat's out of the bag. I'm going to talk about it. So, I mean, I got her testimony. So, and you have people like that who are like still reluctant, even though I think the UFO phenomenon is kind of exploded in the last few years. But yeah, it's always touchy trying to get the story correct, make it a little bit entertaining for the audience without like, like Michael said, you don't actually have to exaggerate anything. I mean, the true stories are beyond strange themselves. So why you have to make it more sensational? You don't.
I suppose, before I let you go, gents, what are some of the additional high strangeness incidents that are occurring here? Obviously, we've touched on people seeing strange lights in the sky. And obviously, 1973, that's not the only time it happened. There have obviously been sightings of UFOs and strange craft and lights prior to that, and there has been considerable numbers in that area since as well, haven't there? But what else has been going on then?
Yeah, definitely a lot of different cryptid activity. We touched upon the Native American legends and lore a little bit. So that's still a thing. There's the old trope of, well, we built this house on a Indian burial mound. It must be haunted. There's 13 Indian burial mounds in the area. So there's a lot of spiritual stories with that. There's a lot of sightings going on with Native American culture. I've got testimony from several people talking about seeing strange wolves in the area that disappear. You know, we don't have wolves in Illinois, you know. So just legends along with that. Orbs, a lot of strange orbs in the woods. You know, this is a major fault line that runs through this area. So in my mind, that could be caused by plates pushing against each other, you know, causing, you know, some type of electromagnetic anomalies. You don't know. I mean, people have seen crafts, orbs flying alongside their vehicles, traveling along this area. Different paranormal activity. Yeah.
We can also, as I mentioned earlier, there's, I think, been at least like 4 massacres just within this one area. The pirates were massacred. I think there was a couple of native massacres, and there was like some uprising, and then all the flooding, you know. Yeah. So there's a lot of ghost stories. There's haunted cemeteries, and then like the park and the Devil's Backbone. As well as the other side, there are ghost stories. But we can't miss, you know, the big feature itself is that big tower rock. Hmm. Everything is centered around this tower rock. The town was named after Grand Tower. So it's sort of the focal point, you know. You'll see pictures of it, you know, where it's just jutting out there. And it's, you know, it's almost like a Close Encounters type thing, you know. It's it makes you think, and it makes you wonder how many ships have been destroyed in the eddies just there it creates. You know, why right there is there electromagnetic stuff going on? There's just so much of that stuff, you know, the ghost stories and the electromagnetic stuff. I've been there and I've talked to people. I've heard about weird groups. I've seen like a two-legged dog there once. I took my family to the park, and it's probably just a hunter cleaning his wares, but there was like probably 20 or 30 like goat legs all along the riverbank. And it's some of that's just rural type stuff.
When you're in
the right environment where you're going to a place that is weird and you see weird things popping up, you know. I said this as a paranormal researcher, that the most common paranormal thing that you experience are those little synchronicities.
Yeah.
You know, it's those little tiny messages that a place will give you if you're at the right time, at the right place. You'll see a two-legged dog in a haunted town, you know, or you'll You'll be standing next to the gas pipe when it releases all this extra air. You know, it scares the crap out of you. That's what makes it fun. That's what makes it interesting. My kids to this day call that place Goat Leg Town. Because that's what they remember. They remember just seeing this horrific sight of some animals that have been butchered. And but that's not the paranormal stuff. You know, the paranormal stuff is the ghosts, UFOs, and all that, and how they definitely peaked there in 1973. And I think Joe, you know, has been playing around with this for a couple of years, talked to a lot of people, got some great shots, a lot of good footage. It's a beautiful place. I think he got the drone out and had some friends out at different times. So, there'll be stuff to look at, and I think it'll be mysterious, and as it should be, and it should be fun, we'll explore it through this film.
I think it's crucial as well, because as we said at the beginning, you know, we're not being flippant about this. This is a place that has suffered some environmental catastrophes that we can only imagine, and it would seem that it's not going to take much to finish this place off. I think if the flooding continues to the level it is, and like we were talking about it being on a fault line earlier, this is the other aspect I think that often gets overlooked about mid-America, is some of these places are prone to earthquakes. And I think unless it happens on either the east or the west coast, for anybody outside of the US, they don't seem to notice much about the amount of earthquakes that happen in this particular area. And as you were saying, this is another train of thought and a theory, that are these sometimes responsible for releasing strange light, strange gases? Is that connected to it? We don't know, because it's one of these things that only seems to have recently started to be looked at more than just folklore or fairy stories, that perhaps people are seeing strange lights and then there's an earthquake, or they happen in the aftermath. We're not sure yet. And I think, as you referred to earlier, Michael, about not having these kind of places being recorded and studied properly, and going to the usual places that seem a bit cliched these days, because, as you say, it seems to have easy access for TV crews, whereas perhaps places like Grand Tower are where we can even attempt to unlock some of these mysteries that are baffling us so many times.
Yeah, Earthlights is definitely on the list of explanations for at least some, you know, localized phenomena. I think that makes sense, especially in areas where there is tectonic stress. It's being postulated, you know, places like Hestelin have played with the notion that there are tectonic and geological aspects to certain places that can create buoyant plasmas at times. Maybe these buoyant plasmas have high electromagnetic fields that can maybe alter perception.
Yeah.
That's been postulated as well. The Earthlights theory, aside from being promoted by people like Paul Devereaux, also has a connection to here in Cape Girardeau. Dr. Harley Rutledge, who ran the Project Identification Study, the first scientific university field study of UFOs out of Southeast Missouri State here in Cape, postulated quite a few times, I think, in Omni magazine that some of these localized, you know, proto stars, as he called, you know, these buoyant plasmas, might have an Earth-like connection, an earthquake-like, a seismic geologic connection in some places. And I think that's demonstrable. And I think we need like geologists and scientists to look at these things. But, you know, it comes down to money and who's willing to fund it. And, you know, but I think we exist in a cheap technology age. We can certainly have cameras put in places, and it's going to happen anyway. You know, we're becoming more and more of a augmented reality surveillance state. You know, once we enter the drone age and we have robot cars, everything's going to have to be monitored and controlled by computers and AI. So we're sort of entering this totality of surveillance period, and the technology is there for us to put cameras up at anomalous places continuously, variety of instruments, You know, it's not like it was in 1973 where those guys had to lug cameras and put up tripods, you know, like literally a two-man operation. You know, we can put game cameras out in places, Zoom cameras, all sorts of stuff just to at least get places monitored and infrared and multi-frequency equipment is cheaper and cheaper. You can put some of these arrays up in places, I think, for just a few thousand dollars and have it continually hooked up to, you know, like solar power to connect it up to the internet. I think that is going to come eventually. And I think we'll probably get more anomalies. And I think some of them will be related to some of these natural phenomena, which we're still discovering. Brights and all this other stuff. We've just discovered that within the past few decades, folks. You know, something that's been part of our planet forever and in the atmosphere, and we're still discovering it.
Yeah.
And there's more for us to discover. We're on a big, giant battery, you know, going through space at thousands of miles an hour. And there's got to be things that are going on. And hopefully we can get to, you know, a proper way of looking at our own environment around us.
Well, the trailer looks fantastic. I can't wait for the full release. So, where can everybody keep up to date with what's happening with the film? I know you're still running a Kickstarter at the minute as well. And when can we expect a full release, gents?
Yeah, so probably the best place for updates is on Facebook. We have a Grand Tower page. It's called Grand Tower UFOs and Other High Strangeness. And that's the name of the Kickstarter campaign. The Kickstarter campaign runs about another 15 days or so. And although it's fully funded, I always set the bar a little bit low just so because on Kickstarter, it's all or nothing. So you have to meet your goal or you don't get any funding.
Yeah.
But it's also a great platform, obviously. But so we could always use more funding. I need it for marketing purposes, mostly, you know, to get the word out. That's like one of the most important things you can do for a film is to market it properly, you know. So most of the film is actually in the bag. There's still some things I need to do. Michael is narrating the film, so at some point we're going to get together and record narration and work on different elements, storytelling elements of it as well, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm already putting things together. I suspect that on my end the editing will be complete early June. Doesn't take much to get it out on streaming. So streaming should be, I'm saying September. It could be before that though. Kickstarter people will get copies before it's streaming. So if anybody wants to participate in that and help us with the journey, please consider a small pledge, pledge money, get rewards. So, yeah, we already have our producer levels. We have 10 producer levels that have already been sold out by a lot of people. You might recognize their names because they're in the community. They put out their own stuff. And they like supporting things like this. So if anybody wants to be a part of that, please consider doing so. Kickstarter page, just look up Grand Tower. You'll see it on there. And then Facebook is Grand Tower UFOs and Other High Strangeness.
Fabulous. Well, I'll put links to the show notes as always, so everybody can track both sites down for you guys and hopefully give you a bit more support, both for the page and also for the Kickstarter, and get this moving forward and get you marketing budget all the way up so we can expect to see you on Good Morning America, Joe, talking about this. and so I can only ask you, what's next then, chaps, after this?
Oh my goodness, so who knows? But I have brought it up. I don't know if he even wants to mention this. I brought it up to Michael recently. There was another incident in the area back in 1941, closer to where Michael lives. And it's relatively unknown, which is really strange to me. It's another UFO incident. I think it was a kind of a major incident that I don't know, for whatever reason, kind of seems I feel like it's covered up, you know, so
yeah.
We might be getting more into that.
Joe is beating about the bush there, but it's the it's the Cape Girardeau UFO crash. He's talked about maybe exploring that in a documentary. That's where I'm at. I'm in Cape Girardeau. I'm the one UFO guy here in town. And it's an interesting story in itself. I think certainly it's worthy of a documentary. There's a lot, actually, that's been done by different researchers relative to this case, myself being one. And it's you know, a Roswell-type scenario that happened to be before Roswell, but it also has Roswell connections. So that's an interesting sort of thing that I think should also be taken down and put into a movie form so that people can explore the lore and the case itself. I have my own views as to what was the likely source. I'm probably going to be the most skeptical person in the film, but I'm also, you know, the key researcher, and I'm also a lifelong UFO researcher. So I'm never going to say that, you know, I know the final answer, because nobody knows the final answers. It's all opinions. It's all interpretations. It's who you choose to think is credible, what piece of evidence you think is credible. And that varies from researcher to researcher, depending on their experience and their own biases. I think it's always best just to be honest, you know, and there's a lot to be told. We'll probably start talking about working on that project after we get done with this one.
Brilliant. Well, where can everybody follow you both online? Keep up to date with your work.
I'm on social media, Michael Huntington. I have Instagram, I have Facebook, I have X, I have TikTok. I do all that stuff. I'm on there quite a bit, stirring up trouble. I'm really active within the UFO community. I promote a lot of UFO reform and do things with researchers and archivists to get history out there and push us in that direction. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Or if you want to see anything that I've written or any other stuff that I've done, just type in my name and in Google and put like UFO behind it or a ghost or a Bigfoot or whatever you're interested in. And I'm sure something will pop up.
Yeah, check out Red Room Creative Media on YouTube. Follow the channel if you'd like. There's some good interviews, one with Michael on there, where we kind of talk about the other side of research besides the promotional media part. So I got a little series on that. There's some free film you can watch on there from earlier documentaries, some outtakes, things like that. And you could always find me wherever there's a weird story in Illinois.
Brilliant. Well, listen, thank you both for your time today. It's been fabulous to speak to you. I wish you the very best of luck. The trailer looks fabulous, and I can't wait to watch the full film. So thank you again both for your time and your hard work with this project.
Thank you so much, Paul. I really appreciate you.
Thank you, Paul. It's nice to finally meet you.